Greetings and salutations to y'all. It's Monday, June the 20th, 2011. The radio program is on the air. Bob McCown, Stephen Brent in our Toronto studios. We are more or less live on the Fan Radio Network coast to coast on Sirius Channel 157 and on Rogers Sportsnet 1, I think. Check your local listings. Some assembly required. Maybe prohibited by law. Ken Holland, your Red Wings managing general, a little bit later on. And Brian Koppelman, if you don't know the name, he is the he wrote the original screenplay for Rounders, the biblical movie about poker.
On Bob McCown's all-time top 10 list.
No. Top 5.
Okay.
And Ocean's 13, which Brent has never seen. He's never seen any of the new Ocean's movies.
No.
I'm trying to remember whether I liked 13 better than I liked 11 or 12, but we'll get into that later on. So Brian will join us. He wrote a fantastic piece on Grantland.com about poker's Black Friday.
He said it was a good thing.
And how it had a beautiful unintended side effect.
There you go.
And we will explore that. Before we do that, Bob Cratchit, he was for many years the sheriff, or at least that's what we called him for many years, of the National Hockey League. Apparently, he's still the senior vice president and director of hockey ops for the NHL, but has given up his sheriff's badge. Here's Coley Campbell. Hello, Coley.
Well, the big question is, and I wondered this since I had my discussion with Trey, what are you going to call me now?
That's a really good question.
Coley.
Well, what's the rest of your job?
Do you need a nickname?
No, you don't need a nickname. You just kept calling me the sheriff, so.
Well, and other people have picked up on it. I saw the Globe and Mail referred to you as the sheriff today.
Do you know? That's right. You set a trend there, so.
Well, I don't know.
Your impact there still carries.
So you still have the same title, but you don't have the same job description. What exactly are you doing now that you weren't doing before?
Well, you know, supplemental discipline was probably a allowed portion of my job, but not a real time-consuming one, other than when you had a tough issue, then, you know, as soon as the alarms went, it was almost like a firefighter, you know, and there was lots of false alarms. Some people thought they were real alarms, but this year was there's a lot of alarms that rang with the blindside hits and increasing concussions. But there's a lot of a lot of things in hockey operations that were in charge of the arenas themselves, video replay, officiating. There's a central scouting. We've got a lot of things. It's just that the discipline, particularly the last few years, took the primary stage. And with the increase in concussions, as I said, it was a real loud portion of my job. So I went to Gary prior to the manager's meeting, and I said, Gary, you know, it's time for someone to grab this baton here. It's someone with fresh eyes and a fresh approach. Maybe we need an increase in the length of suspensions. Maybe we need a lot of things, but I think it's time that we had someone do this. And after 13 years, you get worn around the edges.
Colin, what was the moment for you when you decided, you know, this is the end of the line for me? It's time for somebody else to do it.
Well, the Pacioretty chair hit. It was a number of things, Stephen. It wasn't just one watershed moment. You know, the Pacioretty chair hit. It, in our mind, it was a hit. And as usual, all the issues arise that they do. It happened between two real rivals. It was an injury. We got accused of a lot of things. You know, people outside of hockey got involved, and it was just time, I think, that and I didn't handle it. Mike Murphy handled it, you know, and I felt kind of bad for Mike Murphy. He's handling these things that were in my area because my son played for Boston, so I had to pull myself out of those games. But all in all, Stephen, there wasn't one thing. I think it was just time with the hits, and Brendan had been with us for a year and a half, and he'd seen a lot, and he's got some enthusiasm. He's got some get up and go. So I said, Brendan, just I know you can handle, but get your wife and kids ready for those phone calls. They come often, and they don't choose their time and day.
With Coley Campbell, you mentioned Gregory, your son. Did the incident during this past season, the unveiling of the emails and that whole thing, that had to play a role in this, Coley, didn't it?
A little bit, Bob. You know, like that. Those were honest things I sent, and I'm not ashamed of them. I'm not. They weren't wrong. If someone thinks I was trying to influence the outcome of a game, I was asking a question, and our officials, you know, they call it as they see it. Doesn't matter who asks them the question, whether it's me or Gary Bettman or an owner or whoever, and that's good. In fact, I remember making a call that day, and these were things that came out 3 years ago when we were in the midst of the hearing with the official we terminated. But some blogger brought him up. The same things were in the Toronto Star 3 years later, and a couple of the mainstream media caught on and say it's a slow news day. Let's spin this thing. And Gary Bettman was good with it. You know, he didn't like the fact that we had another angle to this.
Right.
But I called Peter Shirelli and I called my son. I said, "Get ready. There's some crap that's going to come out of here, and it's not being spun the right way, but it's being spun." And later in the day, I called my son. I said, "You okay?" And he said, "Yeah." I talked to Savvy. Savvy was okay, meaning Mark Savard. And I coached Mark his first few years in New York. He said, and a couple of days later, some reporters had come to him over time and suggested a few things. My son was getting irritated. He says, "All I want is a picture of you, me, and Savvy with a Stanley Cup, and we can shove it up these guys, la-di-da-da." So I wasn't there the other night, but I said, "Look, do me a favor, Gary, get that photo of Savvy, will you? And you got a couple good photos, so if I can find the address of this blogger, we're going to send him that photo."
Colin, was there any suggestion from your bosses, or the commissioner especially, that they wanted to make a change at this stage, that they thought it was time to get you out of there?
No, not at all. Gary's been very supportive, the process, Stephen, in supplemental discipline is, you know, he can't be part of it because he's the appeal process. And he's been supportive of, you know, he'd ask the questions when I would tell him, "Gary, I made the decision." He said, "Were you sure it was this? Were you sure it was that? Did you take this in consideration?" I said, "Yes, yes, yes, Gary." And so we've taken everything into consideration, and this is the number we've given him. He said, "Okay, good." He's been very supportive, Stephen, and never once did he question me. In fact, he asked me about the, you know, I remember we went through the Savard, we're at the manager's meeting, and the Savard cook hit. I said, "Gary, I'd love to suspend Matt Cook in this one. You know, I think he knew what he was doing, but I can't find anything illegal here, so I can't do it." And so he was supportive there, and, you know, that got a lot of criticism out of Boston at the time, but in certain areas. But Gary's been very supportive, and I just told him, it's time, Gary, I think, for the position for a lot of reasons. It's time. 13 years is a long time. You know, it's over 450 suspensions. I think we had two appealed during those times by teams. So not a bad record. And the managers have been supportive after the fact. At the time, I've had lots of people don't hear those calls. Those are the tough calls. Those are the spirited calls. Those are the profanity-laced calls. These guys are under pressure lots of times, and you know what it's like. A couple of games can mean the difference between a playoff spot or not, and we've had some tough conversations with a number of managers over the years, but at the end of the day, I can look them in the face at the year-end meeting, and I don't have a problem with them, and they've been supportive. And every year, Stephen, we review where we're at with supplemental discipline at the year-end meeting, and I said, "You guys want anything to change? You want to increase it? You want to do this? You want to do that?" And they've been comfortable all along. So, no, to answer your question, that was a long answer to your short question, but no, Gary never suggested, you know, it's time to step down, and he was actually quizzical, you know, surprised when I approached him last March.
Now, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but listening to you here, it sounds like you got a few scars from those 13 years that all the bullets didn't bounce off. Is that fair?
No, that's fair. That's fair. If you do any job where, and I hate to use this word, it's a little bit overused here in the millennium, a passion, but if you really care and care what people say, care what you guys say. You guys, that's your living, talking sports, mostly hockey. Care what everybody says. Sure, you're sensitive. You want to do the right thing. And one thing you have to understand, this job, you can't please too many people. Sorry about that, guys. I'm in an airport here. Someone went out the wrong door. I'll get outside. But if you really care, it does penetrate you at times, and the criticism does get to you, but you've got to stay, you got to hang in there. I'll get outside here. Sorry about that.
That's all right, Coley. Take your time.
That's LaGuardia.
Don't go through any doors that aren't marked no exit, or we'll get you arrested. We don't need that.
I'll see you went through the wrong door.
Well, somebody did.
Sorry about that. Here we are.
That's okay. So, over the course of the years that you have guested with us, and let me say that I don't remember a single time when Coley Campbell ducked us. There have been times when you couldn't be on the show or had to delay for a day or two, but I don't remember a single time where Coley Campbell said, "I'm not going to come on to talk about a particular issue." And we want to acknowledge that and say that, you know, we admire and respect you for that. Having said that, over the course of that time, I believe that there's been an evolution in Coley Campbell's opinion of, observation of the way the game is played in the National Hockey League. And you're going to tell me if I'm nuts, and that'll be okay too. But I believe when we first started talking to you in this capacity, you were far more militant in terms of the game was fine. It doesn't need very many changes. And then over the course of talking to you, every once in a while, you would throw something in that would throw me completely for a loop. And I assume Stephen, I remember one time a few years ago where you said, you know, maybe it's time to get fighting out of the game.
Yep.
And I wonder, as you leave this portion of your career behind you, whether you're comfortable with the way the game is being played today, comfortable with the punishment that is being meted out, comfortable that the league is seriously addressing things like hits to the head, et cetera, et cetera. Or are there things in there that continue to frustrate you?
You know, Bob, I think the one fact that keeps coming back to and we question, we Jerry put together a blue ribbon committee, and we talk about it, and more or less it's four players that have played for 20 years and or more. Eiserman, Neuendijk, Blake, and Shanahan. They said, look at these hits. See if us old fogies are missing something. It's been a long time since I coached, let alone played.
Sure.
And so those guys looked at it, and they were missing some things too. And they just left the game, but things like replays, guys, or, you know, I had to remind them the other day, and we looked at a bunch of hits, and I said, guys, remember, these are 8 or 10 hits over the course of 1,300 games and 55,000 recorded hits, but they're hits that did some damage, and what do you think we can do to get them out of the game? But bear in mind, these aren't things that happen every night, but there's things that happen. So looking at you know, we don't want one player hurt, but it's going to happen. And sure, I do. I get mad at the victim sometimes. Still, yes, I do. I think when they get to the National Hockey League, they have to have their head up. They have to be ready. But we also have to. It has changed. I can tell you this: it's not as vicious and mean with dirty things like it was in the 80s or 70s. Because we just don't play that way anymore, and you can't get away with that. But there still are hard hits, and there still are players that, when they hit, you know it. And the one thing I did figure out in this job is that when players do hit other players, there are some players that try to hurt them, and I could suspend probably 5 to 10 players based upon the fact that I know they tried to hurt that guy, even though I can't prove they did something wrong. And those are the kind of things that those are the players and the things you got to get out of the game.
Honestly, did you feel you had your hands tied in terms of meeting out discipline from time to time? In other words, that there was a man, there was a general umbrella over the decisions that you made. In other words, the general managers wanted this kind of discipline. And did you have trouble with that from time to time?
Yeah, I think, you know, if someone were to do this discipline in a different way, my recommendation would be this. And I know it can't be done this way because of the politics of the league and the Players Association and everything, but I think the best way to do this discipline would be to stand back, look at the play, know everything, know the game, render a decision, and not have to answer to anybody, not have to go on your show, not have to answer the managers, just render a decision and not care about the pressures that are out there, not listen to what people are saying, and just do it.
Right.
Because I think the pressures of justifying the decision, you're never going to get away from that, Bob. You're going to always have to do it. You're going to have, you know, the manager on the call, the player on the call, the player's agent on the call, the PA on the call, and then you're going to have to justify it afterwards, and you're going to have to go on Hockey Night in Canada or Versus and talk about it, and they're going to talk about it. But if you could really just stand up there and say, I know what this one is. I know why that guy did it. I'm giving him 12 games. See you later.
Colin, do you think for Brendan Shanahan it's going to be any easier?
No, it wouldn't be easier for anybody, Stephen. It's a tough thing to do. It's you know, like, I don't remember. I don't know if there's every – we compare hits. When something happens, I've got a good staff. Gary, give me the ability to hire good people, and, you know, we're up there all night long, and, you know, I remember this – probably the last suspension I did, it was Bobby Ryan when he stomped on the guy's foot, you know, it was about 12:45 at night. We had a lot of long games, a lot of overtimes, and a lot of long series in the first round, and we were just wrapping up for the night, and we're going, no, he didn't do that, did he? He just didn't do that. And we pulled out all the kicks. We looked at a lot of things. There was nothing similar to it. There was a couple of things, you know, but nothing. It wasn't major, but it wasn't bad, but it was, I guess it was stupid, Stephen. And we're going, this is a playoff. He's their best player, one of their best players. Like, you know, we have to sit him down. He just, you know, if a kid like, if, you know, some peewee kid in Brandon, Manitoba, is watching this, he can say, Dad, is that okay? Can I do that? You know, and we're going to say, no, that's wrong. You can't do that. You know, so we had to suspend him. So there's not one discipline that was ever the same as another. It was similar things, but. And going forward, it'll be difficult for Brendan. And Brendan's a guy who cares, and you know, we've talked about things and beat up things since he's joined us. And it, for anybody, it'll be tough, Stephen.
Coley, have a nice summer. I know you don't get all of it off, but you get at least some time to reflect and regenerate your batteries. You know, you're always welcome here under any circumstance, Sheriff or not. And thanks a lot, as always, for your time and your candor. We appreciate it.
Thanks,
okay,
Cole.
Sorry about the background noise there. Scott here at the airport and Air Canada, you know, a little bit delayed today. But thanks again for having me on.
Colin always Campbell, thank you. We appreciate it, too. You know that. The Senior Vice President, Director of Hockey Ops for the National Hockey League. No longer the head of discipline, or as we like to call him, the Sheriff. Ken Holland is the Red Wings general manager. Good news, Nick Lidstrom has signed for another year. Bad news, the cap is up to $64 million with a floor of $48 million. We'll see how bad that news is for Ken Holland and explain why it might not be as irrelevant as you might think when Primetime continues on the Fan Radio Network, Sirius 157 and Rogers Sportsnet. Six past the hour, McCowan here, Brent there. Later, Brian Koppelman, who wrote the original screenplay for Rounders. He wrote Ocean's 13, I guess the screenplay for that as well. And did a piece on the web about Black Friday for online poker. and how it had a beautiful unintended side effect. And so we're going to talk about all kinds of different things with Brian Koppelman in just a few minutes. But first, one of our favorite people, he is the managing general of the Detroit Red Wings. Here's Ken Holland. Hello, Kenny. How are you?
Good. Nice to be with you.
Our pleasure, as always. So, good news. Last time we talked, you hadn't talked to Nick and didn't know what his situation was going to be. You weren't 100% sure. You were hopeful, but not confident, maybe. Now you got the word. Nick Lidstrom will be back for what is, what, a 20th season in the NHL? Is that right?
Yeah, obviously great news for us, especially with Brian Rafalski retiring.
Of course.
Nick has been so important to our team. He's a finalist for the Norris Trophy. If you don't look at the birth certificate, he continues to be one of the best defensemen in the world and, again, one of our most important players. So I think people look at the birth certificate and think that his skills are diminishing, but Nick is one of those guys that has defied Father Time, and he would be, especially losing Rafalski and Lidstrom in the same offseason, would have been, I guess I would use the word devastating, but thrilled to have Nick back.
I guess. Now, Ken, what do you think tipped the balance in terms of Nick's decision to come back? It's certainly on the ice, he hasn't lost a whole lot, remarkably, considering how long he's played, but what do you think influenced his decision to play another season?
Well, he talked a lot today in the press conference about motivation. His standards are very high, and I think if he's going to come back, he wants to know that he's prepared. You know, people see the games. That's really the dessert for an athlete. It's all about the work that you do year-round, and especially in the off-season. And Nick had talked today about the older you get, the harder you have to work to prepare to play at a similar level. So I think that he wanted to take some time and make sure that he was motivated to come back, talk to his family. His one son spent all winter going to school and playing hockey in Sweden. And, good news for us, he is motivated. But, obviously it's taken him longer. He met talked today a little bit. It's taken him longer every summer to make those decisions. So obviously he's taken it a year at a time, and we're thrilled to have him back for the upcoming season.
Compare Lidstrom at this point in his career, maybe with a guy like Chelios at this point in his career, or can you?
Well, at age 40, in 2002, when we won the Cup, Chelly was the runner-up to Nick Lidstrom for the Norris. Nick won the Norris, and Chelly was the runner-up. So now Nick is a year older. Nick is a runner-up. Nick is a finalist for the for the Norris Trophy. I think that Nick talked today. He's not going to hang, around the game when he's no longer one of our best defensemen. He's on the ice in all key situations. Chelly would still be playing now, I think. If we give him a contract, but Nick is Chelly. Obviously, they both defied Father Time. I think that Chelly got it done because of heart determination, his instincts. Nick continues to be a tremendous skill player that runs a power play, can generate attack. I don't know that Chelly Chelly was a great defender. A little bit different, but obviously when you got guys at the age of 40 being finalists for the Norris Trophy, they're special players.
Now, since we're talking about guys at that stage of their career, the other Detroit story that's been floating around, Ken, is the idea that you guys would be, that Jaromir Jagr wants to come back from Russia and play another season, and that you guys might be interested. It does sound like a Detroit Red Wings kind of move to a lot of people, and I just wonder about your level of interest and what you think. I think the last time most people saw Yaro was at the Olympics. What you think he has left right now?
Well, it's probably a Detroit Red Wing move because it probably appears to be a youth movement. we have had some conversations with his agent. I have had some conversations. It is a bit of a Red Wing move. We are open to star players coming in the later stages of their career if we think they can be a fit. So Jaromir is exploring whether he wants to leave the KHL and come over to North America, and I think there's other teams that are interested beyond us, so I'm not sure where it's at. We have had conversations. We continue to stay in touch. I think while Jaromir is deciding what he wants to do, but we do have some interest.
Yeah, with Ken Holland, the general manager of the Detroit Red Wings. With the arrival or return, if you will, of the NHL to Winnipeg, it has been suggested or stated, in fact, that there will be realignment. And there may be even more than realignment. There may be a complete juggling of the cards in the NHL deck. You've been quoted as suggesting that if you had your personal druthers, the Red Wings would be back in the East. Is that accurate?
Yes. Yeah.
And do you think there's a case to be made? Does your owner, first of all, agree with you? And do you think there's a chance that this might happen?
Yeah, everybody in our organization, from the Illiches on down through Jim Devolano, you know, I just think we should be in the East, really, for our fans. You know, we play a lot. We'd like to have our road games on at 7 to 8 o'clock instead
sure.
of half or three-quarters of our road games on at 9 o'clock to 10:30. I think I think from a competitive standpoint, I think our players have gotten used to being in the Western Conference. I think that, but our fans, I think, you know, still is that, you think about for us playing all those Eastern Conference teams at least a couple of times at home, you know, all those original six teams,
right.
and teams that we have history with. So I think it's, again, from a competitive standpoint, I think we're okay to be in the Western Conference. We've got our own plane. Our players are used to it. They know what's up. But I think that our fans would really like us to be in the Eastern Conference because of the timing of the road games, and also there's so many rivalries in the East. So certainly, if we're going to lobby, we'd like to be in the East. But at the end of the day, we're going to do whatever we think is best for the league. But certainly, our preference is to move East if it makes sense for everybody else.
Now, you say your players are used to it, and I know they're not flying in the 44th row of a commercial flight, so it's not like other people traveling. But if your base trip, road trip, turned into, instead of being 2 or 3 hours or more, potentially going to the coast, turned into an hour or an hour and a half, does that change things, do you think, over the course of a long season for a team?
Yeah, I think the other thing, I mean, if we stayed in the West, we'd like to see a more balanced schedule. Like, we'd like to probably cut one trip out. You know, we do two trips to California and two trips to Western Canada. You know, we'd like to maybe have more games against the East and you know, cut out one of those trips. So, you know, again, we want to be good partners. Our preference is to be in the East. But I think our fans would prefer us to be in the East. But if we're in the West, we'd like to see a more balanced schedule. And obviously, in the playoff time, we've this year back and forth to Phoenix and back and forth to San Jose. We've done that a number of times. So, you know, playoffs, it gets tough. But I guess it's the same for the team you're playing against. They're going back and forth. But, you know, it's we'll see. It's obviously going to be an interesting next 12 months.
All right, to say the least, with Ken Holland. Last point of discussion. Clubs and agents are being told that the salary cap for next year will be at $64 million with a floor of $48 million. Kenny, is it just me, or is this Looney Tunes, a floor of $48 million? Now, I know the Red Wings don't fit into that problem. That's not something that you need to address. But isn't it nuts to have a floor of $48 million in the National Hockey League?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's all based upon revenues generated from this season. So, you know, obviously there's revenue sharing where the big market teams are helping the smaller teams. So, you know, I think the biggest thing, you know, I think the best thing that's happened coming out of 2005 with the salary cap, you just look at the parity. I mean, I think of the 15 playoff series this year, 7 went to game 7. We were in third place. I think we were 9 points out of ninth. So certainly, I think that the parity and the salary cap, the floor and the ceiling, has created an exciting league for our fans. Is the floor too high? I don't. It's hard to say that because again, everything's tied to revenues and the players have negotiated their percentage.
Yeah, and I know it's unfair to ask you because you're not in that position. And, I'm effectively asking you to speak for one of the other general managers. But Stephen and I were talking about it earlier, and I opined to him. I said, you know, if you cut the floor from $48 million to $24 million, if you cut it in half, there might be a half dozen teams in the National Hockey League that still couldn't make money. And at $48 million, I just don't know how the current economics work. Can you explain it?
Well, I just get back to I get back to the race, the races in the West. You know, it's impossible for me to talk about the economics of 29 other teams.
I understand.
You know, so I don't know what the economics of the 29 other teams. I just get that certainly coming out of 2005. I think that with the change in the rules and the change to a floor and a ceiling, I think our game is in the best shape competitively than it ever has been in the history of the National Hockey League. From, you know, I really can't talk about the economics for the other 29 teams.
Fair enough. I know you got a draft coming up. You got other things going on in the summertime. Hopefully, I'm sure you will get a little bit of time to rest and relax and recharge. And we wish you a good summer. And we thank you, as always, for the time that you spend with us. We'll talk to you again soon, I hope.
Yeah, thank you. Nice talking to you.
Ken Holland, general manager of the Detroit Red Wings. And it is difficult. I mean, it's impossible for him to speak to $48 million as a floor, but boy.
Well, and he's right. It is attached to revenues, and there That's has been right. overall revenue growth in the league. But I think what jumps out for people is that, and again, we know this because of the Phoenix bankruptcy when everything went public, and we know to a degree about what was said about the Atlanta franchise before it moved to Winnipeg, that if some teams are losing $20, $30, $40 million on an operating basis, and yet the cap is going up and the floor is going up, then you've got a problem.
Well, yes, and as you would acknowledge, we understand that while revenues are going up, they are not going up at the same percentage everywhere. In fact, the rich continue to get richer.
Mm-hmm.
The poor continue to get poorer. The divide between rich and poor in terms of economics is ever widening.
Well,
and the punishment that has been meted out through this ridiculous collective bargaining agreement to those poorer franchises is they are mandated to continue to lose more money every year.
Yes, they will get revenue sharing, but it doesn't compensate for where the revenues are going. And if this was a non-capped and an uncapped system right now, you would have teams at the top who would be quite willing to spend more than $64
million. Oh, yeah.
But I guarantee you, you would have a lot of teams at the bottom who would be taking it right down to the wood and spending $25 or $30 million or maybe less.
Or less. The break. When we come back, Brian Koppelman, the original screenplay writer of Rounders and of Ocean's 13, and he wrote a very interesting piece online, and we're going to talk to him about that and more when Primetime continues. You're listening on the Fan Radio Network Coast to Coast on Sirius Channel 157 or watching on Rogers Sports. Before the air, Bob McCown, Stephen Brunt in our Toronto studios. It's the nation's most listened to sports talk presentation. It's Primetime on the Fan Radio Network around the world and up your street on Sirius Channel 157. And if you don't own a radio, it's on Rogers Sportsnet in high definition. Brian Koppelman wrote the original screenplay for Rounders. He worked on Ocean's 13, and he wrote a great piece on Grantland.com about Black Friday for online poker. And we want to talk to him about that and a few other things. And Brian Koppelman joins us on the phone. Hi, Brian. How are you?
How are you, Bob? Great to be here with you.
It's good of you to join us. Listen, before we go anywhere...
I know where you're going here. I've been waiting for this. This is Bob's fanboy moment of the day. So
yeah,
go ahead.
So I'm sort of a Rounders freak. You know, I'm one of those guys who saw it right at the beginning. Not because I'm a poker player necessarily, but I love the movie. Whether it was cult or otherwise, it was certainly cult in my family. So here we are all these years later. Daniel Negreanu is a pretty good friend of mine. I know a lot of the guys in the poker world. Every one of them swears this was the movie that they've certainly seen 100 times if it didn't launch their interest in the sport. Why have we not seen a sequel?
Well, first of all, thank you. I'm so glad. You know, all we wanted was to write, when I say we, it's not the royal we or the Lebowski we. It's my partner, David Levine, and I. Dave's been my best friend since we're 15 years old. We wrote the movie together. And all we wanted to do was write a movie that would be for a new generation of people the way that movies like Diner were for us, where we would just quote them over and over and over again, or like the Coen Brothers movies were for us. So to hear that guys, you know, watch it over and over and that inspired all these poker players is great. And what I'll say is, it's closer in a way right now, a second, movie than it's ever been before.
Really?
Yeah, there was an item in the New York papers recently about it. I mean, it's public that we've all been talking. Matt Damon would love to do it. We'd love to do it with him. We're all just trying to figure it out if we all have the time and can all make, you know, deals to do it.
Have you scribbled anything on a napkin or anywhere?
I really don't want to say too much about it other than, yeah, we all kind of know what the movie would be.
Okay.
Finally, which we didn't for a long time, and it means too much to all of us to go back to those characters. We have to do it right. There are too many people who care too much. It's what, whether or not it launched the poker boom, it certainly launched our career. So, and I'm very attached to those characters, and I understand the impact that the movie's had on people. So, you know, we can't screw it up.
I hear you.
Brian, did Rounders get you into poker, or did poker get you into Rounders?
No, that's a good question. Poker got, I was working another job, and the job I had allowed me to be out at night a lot. I was an A&R guy for record companies. So I was searching for talent, and, you know, you'd go into a club, you'd hear one song. Let's say the song, for lack of a more colorful word, let's say it sucked. You could either stay for seven songs that were probably going to get worse by some kind of factor because people open with their best song, or I could go to the local poker club, underground poker club, and just play cards for hours. And that's what I ended up doing. And after the first night I walked into a poker club, I called Dave and I said, I think I know this movie, you know, that we should write. And we both started going every night and taking notes. And I probably spent 2 years playing poker 5-6 times a week. And then in writing the movie, was able to sort of mostly, you know, get it out of my system.
Did you evolve into an online player then?
I was an official friend of Full Tilt Poker, and I did play online, but I was never, I've never been an obsessed online player. I mean, do you play online?
No.
So people who, you know, I would play a couple hours a week sometimes, then I wouldn't play for a while. I certainly had a few Sundays that, you know, I had the kids and everybody saying, are you still playing poker online? Because you'd start a tournament, and if you did well, maybe you'd be going all day, and then,
yeah,
you know, you'd lose and say, but I wasn't obsessed with it. The time that I was an obsessed card player was really, there were two times. One was when we were making Rounders, and then we made this show on ESPN called Tilt, and while we were doing Tilt, I was pretty, you know, I got back pretty deep into it again. But that's it.
So what is it? What did it mean?
When I beat your buddy Daniel when we were shooting Tilt.
Oh yeah.
I played Daniel heads up for $100, and I beat him, and I still have the $100 on the wall.
Nice. I will mention that to him. By the way.
Oh, please mention it to him.
In fact, I'll mention it to him the next time he's on air. I'll wait until he's on air so I can publicly embarrass hell out of him.
Please say compliment. Please say compliment. Still stares at the 100. Please.
So now comes Black Friday, and the big three online sites are effectively shut down, sort of, in the United States.
Yes.
What did that mean?
Well, I want to be really clear. Because although 99% of the people who read that piece understood it and tweeted their approval and wrote in, 1%, I'd say, decided that they thought I said I was for the closing of the online sites. So let me be really clear. I think online poker should be legal. I think, and I say this in the piece very clearly, I think it should be legal. I think it's absurd that the government is involved in this in any way. But I did say there's an unintended consequence, which is, for me, poker always had a romance. When I started playing poker, it was an underground. That's what I was saying. I would leave the rock clubs, and I would go to these underground rooms. And people who made the choice to be card players were sort of making a choice back then to live on the fringes of society. And if you look at the movie characters who are card players, if you look at the movie characters in Rounders, these are people who didn't need a government to give them permission, who didn't need anybody to give them permission, who were living a kind of a gunslinger's alternative existence. And as a writer, like as a citizen and as a card player and as a voting person and an active political person, I think it's absurd that the poker sites are shut, that the government thinks they should regulate this. But as a writer, as somebody who grew up watching crime movies, as someone who watched Westerns, I love the idea that once again the card player's on the edge as a society. There's just something cool about them living. You know, it's like I'm a guy who likes it when men wear the right kind of hats outside. You know, when you see the old pictures of a baseball game and every guy had some sort of a fedora or something.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just a cooler time. And that doesn't mean I think that people should do that now. I wear a ball cap, but there's something about that other reality that's just romantic and cool.
Listen, we got to get out of here because music's playing and we got to go. And you have to go too because you have work to do on Rounders 2.
Yes, I do.
And please,
thank you for having me, guys.
Hurry up. It's been our pleasure. Thanks, Brian. You're welcome here anytime. Brian Koppelman was the writer of the original screenplay of Rounders, also of Ocean's 13 and a bunch of other movies. We thank him, Ken Holland, Coley Campbell for joining us on the program. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you tomorrow night on Primetime Sports.